In many ways, the talk I'm about to give, the presentation, is an extended thank you, Andy. Andy's work has inspired decades of scholarship on what we might learn about the theaters, the actors, and the audiences of the great flourishing of dramatic art that occurred in London more than 400 centuries ago. Like every scholar, I am grateful for that. But your work, Andy, also helped to lay the foundation for two magnificent buildings that are flourishing today, Shakespeare's Globe and the American Shakespeare Center's Blackfriars Playhouse. These buildings in themselves give us a glimpse of what we might have seen in that great first flourishing, and we are grateful for that, and for the pleasant arguments we can have over what we got right and what we got wrong. But to me, the most important thing about these two buildings is that they are prosperously producing plays. And that work has created a remarkable feedback into the active world of playmaking. Your work, therefore, not only lets us glimpse the past, it also, in ways I would like to suggest today, lets us glimpse the future. So I am, as a lover of plays and theater, grateful to you for that. But in saying thank you for your work, I'm saying a personal thank you. Because one of the two buildings you inspired, the Blackfriars Playhouse, is my workspace, the center of my life as a director and a teacher of Shakespeare and his contemporaries. My presentation today tries to answer three questions about a building we call the Blackfriars Playhouse in Virginia, that's what we call it. But it's referred to sort of generally as the Blackfriars Theater. And the first part of that talk will be something that many of you who've already been to these will know, and so I'm going to do it very briefly, and that is what was London's Blackfriars Theater. So I'm just going to not spend a whole lot of time on that. That part of the presentation will be just a brief overview. The second part is how did a recreation of that theater come to be built in Virginia? This part of the presentation will tell the story of the recreation of the Blackfriars. And part three, to me the most important part of the talk, is what is a recreation of the Blackfriars or the Globe or any early modern theater good for? I'll try to answer the first two questions in 15 minutes, but not before I say start. And then devote the rest of my time to the third question. My argument, my thesis is that the recreation of Shakespeare's two theaters may have started as a valuable inquiry into the history of theater, but that these buildings also have equal value in determining its future. And I just say, and I'll be doing this a lot off book, you can't go and see the new Royal Shakespeare Company's theater in Stratford without knowing that it's been influenced by this work. I mean, everybody sort of realized, wait, these may work better in this circumstance. And it took the rebuilding of the Globe, I think, to do that. So I'm going to try all this great technology and see how I do. What is 16 tons? One fist of iron, the other steel. If the left one don't get you, then the right one will. My title comes from William Shakespeare and John Fletcher's Henry VIII. The most convenient place that I can think of for such receipt of learning is Blackfriars. There ye shall meet about this weighty business. I will not be doing all the quotes. I have some readers I have asked to help me, so you won't have to listen only to my voice. Part one, then, is the old convenient place to meet. The Dominicans built a new monastery. The Archbishop of Canterbury acquired the land in 1275. And King Edward I persuaded the Dean of St. Paul's, who was going to be a near neighbor, to let them move in, to let them go ahead and build in 1278. The name comes from the fact that monks and friars wore black cloaks. And I think in talking about convenience, the first thing you have to realize is that it is, in fact, a convenient place. This is the oldest, earliest printed view of London, and if you're coming in, let me see how this works now. Okay, it's obviously. Here is Hogenberg's view of metropolitan London. And here this is the wall. And here's a close-up of that. And you can see, here's St. Paul's. And here's Temple Bar and Enzo Court. And not only does the Blackfriars have one riverfront, it almost has two, because Fleet was a river then, however unpleasant. And there's the River Thames. And it's quite possible that these buildings here would have been the Blackfriars complex. It was the fourth largest hall in the area, the Blackfriars, large enough for Parliament to be held there, for important events like the Earthquake Council to be held there. Parliament again, apparently luxurious enough for the Holy Roman Emperor to stay there, and important enough for this weighty business, a quote from my original quote. That weighty business is, of course, that having achieved the divorce, he got custody of the brothers and dissolved the monastery. And our story picks up again in 1576 when Richard Farran leases the building, the stage plays with the choristers of St. Paul's. And in 1596, 20 years later, for reasons I think you probably already know, Burbage, looking for a place since he was going to get evicted from his land where the theater was, gambled on converting the hall into a theater with galleries for the Lord Chamberlain's men. Here's a deed for that, and these are the most important words, I guess, in the deed. It tells us that, and how about, with the mic, you go ahead first, Rick, and then pass it to somebody.
All those seven great upper rooms, as they are now, they all come going forward, sometime being one great entire room with the roof over the same kind of land.
To me, that's the most important thing, and I think that in trying to figure out what it looks like, we have very little information. Here's the globe. And this is probably the Blackfriars. And if we move in closer, the best we can do is see that. And I'm just, we don't know for sure. What might it have looked like? Well, we just heard from the deed about the rooms, but it seems to have been upstairs. So, reader. Another reader. Oh, you go ahead.
The owl will call in at the Blackfriars, and we should see a nest of boys aiming to ravish a man.
All right, take us in, all the way.
That roving nest of pernicious birds dare roost themselves there.
I think it's interesting that every time they get referred to, in these airy terms, I put eggs up there, and you're looking at a building that Irwin Smith thinks might have been like the refectory at the... The Blackfriars, it would have been a building like that, and it seems to have been something you went upstairs to see, and that gets commented on in those quotes. The renovated interior, this is Irwin Smith's conjecture of what it might have looked like in an elevation, and this was my first, and maybe my last argument with Andy Gurr. Andy thinks that they would have gotten rid of the dropped ceiling that they had there for the dormitory. But as someone who cares about acoustics, not to mention the cost of tearing a thing down, we decided to leave in, to imagine there was a dropped ceiling so that we didn't have to build the rest of the hammerbeam arches that do this. But I actually think it would have been a silly thing to take it down. You would have screwed up your acoustics. Why not have a clear acoustic? And this is his conjecture, which is cute. I think it's very cute, very, very sweet. And it looks a lot like, if you've ever been to the Folger Library, it looks a lot like their little theater. But it would have been a convenient place for other reasons as well. And I want to look at that, too. Now, these aren't Henry's terms so much, but the precinct in which the Black Friars was located, and which gave the precinct its name, was a district. It was a liberty, and that meant it was out of the jurisdiction of the law in many ways. And sort of like Las Vegas, what happened in Blackfriars stayed in Blackfriars. We get some idea of what the inhabitants of the precinct were worried about when they tried to keep it out by some of these terms. And call them out. Would you, Carrie? Go ahead. It was.
A common house. Great annoyance and trouble.
These are things they're worried about.
General inconvenience. Bigger than food persons. All manner of mischief. Great pestering.
I like that one very good.
Visitation of sickness. Drums and trumpets will break the spirit.
And then above all, we will hinder the ministers. We'll probably get back to that. The precinct itself was remarkable for its diversity of inhabitants. It had aristocrats, including George Carey, Second Lord Hunsdon, the Lord Chamberlain, lived there. But some painters of some note lived there as well. These two, for example, Isaac Oliver and Anthony Van Dyck. And gallants lived there. You saw earlier that it was situated close to the Inns of Court, close to St. Paul's, and it drew people, again, it was a liberty, who were interested in some of the things they could get there. They could get false teeth there. There were teeth makers there. It was famous for that. It was famous for its brewers, its glassmakers, its apothecaries. And I'm only going to remark, because I see Andy there, the glassmakers, the apothecaries, and the alchemist. That seems a really interesting thing about setting the alchemists there as well, because one of the things you did when you went to the playhouse was you visited the glassmakers, and the apothecary hall is there now, though it's not an apothecary's hall at the time, but it seems to be associated with that. There were musicians. It was famous. The building itself was famous for the music, but musicians lived there too, and there are many references to the fact that musicians in the neighborhood, and poets and playwrights, including these two, live there, and Puritans. And that seems to me the most interesting part of the story. So I'm going to ask Tom to read a quote from Thomas Randolph's Muses of Looking Glass, because I think you can see that everyone was amused by the fact that this place of theater was also where the Puritans felt the least sort of persecuted and could sell their feathers. And so you had this odd mix. And it's kind of like if all the casinos were in Utah, were in Salt Lake City. Go ahead.
For Puritans selling feathers, you live by Blackfriars College, but I wonder how that profane nest, pernicious birds, dare roost themselves there in the midst of all.
There's that same quote about a nest, and here's another one for you, Tom.
Puritans that once dwelt there prayed and drive through the land, though the land.
So what you have then is this remarkable neighborhood, and people continued to try to close the place, even after in 1608, the king's men were able to get back in. Throughout the period, there were petitions against it. This one complaining, it's basically about traffic and parking, and hackney coaches, and that's the earliest picture I could find of a hackney coach. But I found this very recent shot by just using that little figure on Google Maps, you know, where you can put the Google map down. So I put the Google figure down on Carter Lane, the largest street. You know, London's changed. The buildings have changed a lot, but the streets are pretty much the same. So here is Carter Lane. And this would be about the size of one hackney coach. And that would be about the size of two. So you can see the problem of using this. And again, one of the larger of the lanes in Blackfriars. And I believe, if I'm not correct, that I'm not wrong, that I'm almost at the end here, part one. Let me finish up. So 1530, here's a review. 1538, Henry VIII dissolves the monastery. In 1576, Ferrant leases the buttery, puts on plays in a hall, but not a purpose-built hall. Burbages do that, and then they're not allowed to use the space. So they lease it to the children of the Queen's rebels. And in 1608, as the King's men, they are finally allowed to occupy the second Blackfriars Playhouse. And it survives and thrives until 1642, when the theater's closed and the building is demolished. That brings us to part two, the new convenient place. This begins when Viola de Lesseps, who was the only woman ever to play in an Elizabethan play, and she played, by the way, Juliet. She left for the New World on a ship and was nearly drowned. And when she swam to shore, she found herself near Jamestown. This is her making her way toward Jamestown. And that's the gospel. So she's making her way towards Jamestown, and then she just continues west from Jamestown into the Shenandoah Valley, where she converted many of the natives to a love of Shakespeare that spread throughout the country, where Shakespeare was produced in a variety of ways, many of them diverging from the traditions she had brought with her. The reason I have the big, bold square around Washington is, those of you who want to see the Blackfriars for yourself, that's the most convenient airport to fly into, and I just thought you should know that. But her descendants, sort of many years later, she didn't live to see it because it was some few years later, At a university called James Madison University, some students in a London program there went to visit Sam Wanamaker's Bear Garden, where they met Patrick Spottiswoode, who argued that there was a reason to rebuild the Globe that had to do with finding out how these plays might work, but not just that. And I want to stress that this idea of a reason to build it is so important to me. The second reason, something about theater as well. In 1987, that same university had a seminar on Henry V and original production, and I ran into Alan Dessen just 2 days ago. He visited us for that seminar. And then in 1988, we put on a production of Henry V, and the Shenandoah Shakespeare Express Touring Company formed. This was our logo. We couldn't decide between calling ourselves the Unroyal Shakespeare Company or the Shenandoah Shakespeare Express, which won out. And so what we did was we wore these high-top shoes. This is a 1993 version. I used it because they're the best-looking group we had. But I do want to point out, and I think I can do that with this. Yes, I want to point out these boxes here. One of the things I love about theater as opposed to literature is that when you work in theater, you can steal. And don't have to do a footnote. I thought this terrific idea when we were putting on our productions of building these boxes that the actors could keep their props in, because we were moving all over the country, and we were moving really, you know, we'd go into weird places, lunch rooms, any place to put on a show, and we'd set up our boxes. And I thought that was just really clever. And then about 3 years ago, I was putting together a talk on the Trevor Nunn, Macbeth with Ian McKellen and Judy Dench, and I saw them sitting, it was 77, sitting on 12 boxes. So apparently I stole it from that idea there. So I think it's really important to say, and I'm sure that Viola de Lesseps would approve of this, that we've had support from the start from the Academy. I mean, that's a terribly important part of our story. And I think the reason I like this part of the story the most, I say something all the time to my students in our graduate program, and that is that Shakespeare never woke up in the morning and said, "Today I am an actor, not a playwright," or vice versa. He just didn't divide himself up that way. But the way we've managed our educations and the way we do things is we divide, we get into specialties. And I think the fact that one of the great reasons to build these places is to get a conversation going between the academy and the practitioners, the people who put on the shows and the people who study the shows. And so in 1990, our first really big break was we got an invitation to the Philadelphia meeting of the Shakespeare Association of America to put on Julius Caesar. That attracted the attention of Barbara Mallett, who was running the Folger Institute, and of David Bevington, both of whom were extremely excited about the show and asked us to try to come to their schools near them and started supporting us. But my favorite thing is the Shakespeare Quarterly article by Stephen Booth. And I got to tell you that this is not an easy thing to get into this presentation. But in case you don't visit me, my grave after I'm dead, and on which this will be inscribed, I wanted you just to see two of the things that Stephen Booth said. He said this. How about, Carrie, would you do this one? Isn't that nice? That's really nice. And this other one, too, is good.
All in all, Shenandoah Shakespeare Express gives us all there is to give all kinds of delight inherent in the multiple realities of the dramatic.
Yep. I think Violet Gillespie will be very proud. Because of articles like this, because of the kind of support we were getting, in 1995, we're a very small organization. We won an NEH Institute of Reds. James Madison University won it using us. And we put on this institute. We needed to call it something, so we came up with this really awkward, big-sounding name. But we did that because we liked the acronym. Paul Menzer and I cooked this up. We thought this is right because we believe that in understanding these plays, you have to understand how they worked. Economically, we have to understand that all the artistic decisions that are being made because of economic constraints. I want to go back. I got to set that other one up. So, Etzis Institute was a director from Colorado's Theater Works, and he was one of the visiting artists named Murray Ross. And Murray said to me, "Ralph, did you know that there's an Elizabethan theater right in Harrisonburg, Virginia?" Well, I had been living there for 22 years, and of course I said, no, I had no idea. Come with me, and he took me to the stockyards. And I think this is really a remarkable photograph. Our intern, Sarah Swartzel, just found this out of our archives for me, and it's so beautiful. It does look kind of like a globe. Here would be the doors for the actors to go in and out. Here's the sort of Lord's room where the auctioneer would be. And you know those boxes I showed you earlier? We simply stacked them like that to make two faux pillars so that we could act in that. And we put on a scene from Twelfth Night. Those are the scholars you see here are the scholars in the Institute. That photograph appeared in the Daily News Record, in Harrisonburg's Daily News Record. A man who saw it gave me a phone call the next day, a man named Joe Harmon. Joe Harmon runs a B&B, and he said to me that. Now, why he said it is a really interesting part of the story. And I'm always hesitant to use some of the things that look like just anecdotal, but they seem to be important points. The reason he thought it would be a good idea is that this town had a very, very famous folk gospel group called the Statler Brothers. And every year, the Statler Brothers, because it was their hometown, would put on a free concert on the 4th of July for the citizens. And he was going to be losing custom because they had just decided not to do that anymore. So he thought, let's have a Shakespeare theater instead. I think you have to love that. I love it a lot. Andy, you ruined this for me. But I want all the English in the room, no Americans, to pronounce this word here. Where go? Yes, you pronounce it that way. Please, English people, read this one. Yeah, good. Now do this one. Maudlin, right. So, Americans, you get to do that one. Stanton. Okay. All right, so that's your little exercise. This is Stanton, Virginia. As you can see, it's a really gorgeous, gorgeous town. And I want to bring special attention to these buildings here. This is part of Mary Baldwin College, whose president had the foresight back in 99 to associate the it's a woman's college, but to associate the college with the new theater by creating a graduate program in Shakespeare and performance. So that's my other home now, and it's right up the hill from the theater, which is not in this picture, but it's like two blocks from the theater. So that's Stanton, and I need to talk for a little bit about this wonderful man. This is Tom McLaughlin. Tom McLaughlin, as you see, died recently. The story of his death is worth telling you, especially here and now, because Peter McCurdy is in the room. I was visiting here two Christmases ago, and Peter was having me talk about the Blackfriars, showing slides of the Blackfriars as they work on the new Wanamaker Theater, with this large, it's Allies and, what's the name of the firm? Allies and Morrison. And he kept showing them things that Tom had done. And they kept saying, one man did all this? One man? Yeah, one man and an answering machine, which he very rarely responded to. But he was a wonderful man, and I got back from England in a hurry to tell him the awe in which he was being held and to find out. I have a message on my phone from his son that he had passed away. But he's our architect, and here's his first drawings. And that was a chimney, because he figured that there had to be a chimney. We got rid of that because there wasn't enough space in the building to use a chimney of any sort, or even on the sides of the building. There was going to be a parking underneath. We got rid of that. That became rehearsal space and a classroom. And that became our dressing rooms and a costume workshop. And here we see an overview. I'm going to talk about that later. That's my biggest mistake. We'll talk about that later. And we had a lobby. That's the way we raised money. There were 8 sharers in the Blackfriars, the original Blackfriars, so we sold shares to people. And to do that, you need to have somebody who can help you raise the money. You need, and we actually call the Queen City. And we have a queen, and her name is Lee Cochran. And Lee put together a group of people to raise money for it. And we needed that much, and through private and corporate donations, really with Lee's great help, we raised that, and then we got that money from city, county, and the state. So that's where the money came from. I'm very interested in money. And that's the building we tore down in order to make the Blackfriars. And I want you to notice in particular that the Stonewall Jackson Hotel next to it, which was the pride of the city, had been built in 1937 and was in total decline and was being used as a halfway house. This is the building going up. This is Tom's conception of the Blackfriars exterior. And here it is today on the outside. And here are the two artisans, Paul Borzelka and Tim Cox, who were so useful, and who made the image you've already seen, actually, is the interior. I love this particular angle, so I use it a lot. And I want to show you the things we got wrong. Two of them we got wrong on purpose. We do not have a finished third gallery, though those doors up there open and would allow you to look down. You know, we can make that a third gallery. We just didn't have the money to finish the ceiling, and it seemed the simplest, and we knew we would never sell tickets up there, because really only basically one line of people can stand there and look down on the action, and we figured we wouldn't sell many of those tickets, and if we ever did, then we'd have the money to finish the ceiling. So, and we could not have windows, and we know the place had windows, so what we use are these Fresnels that bounce off the ceiling to sort of simulate daylight, since, as you probably know, the shows at the Blackfriars went on in the daytime. They went on at 2 in the afternoon, and so we simulate daylight that way. The mistake, my big mistake, is there. We'll come back to that again. And I have to be accurate and tell you that we did not start with the painted front scaena. We didn't have the money to do it yet, and by the time the building got built and the board of directors saw it, they said, "You are not painting this place." And I said, "If I don't, Andy Gurr will spank me." And I said it again and again, and finally it was, I get spanked by Lee Cochran or I get spanked by Andy and I decided I'd rather get spanked by Lee. So we did paint the Franziskaner. I do have a picture of it before we painted it. Here is it. Okay, here comes the picture. Before we painted it, it looked like that. And that's some tourist who's blocking the view. I don't know. A good friend of many of the people at the Globe, I just would like to say, let me go back. And do this. You see the set there? That's for Importance of Being Earnest, which was directed by Nick Hutchison, who many of you know, and had come over to direct it. Okay, so that ends the second part. How long have I gone? Has anybody been timing? 19 or 20? I'm sorry, 5 minutes over? That's a world record for me. That's, okay, good. All right. I'm on world record pace. So what's it good for? To make money. And Cass, I want you to read this next one. Okay, so loudly. To make money, or as there are, as some people would have it, you bet. Show me the money. Stanton invested $500,000 in this. They got a percentage increase in lodging taxes, and I only have from 2003, not from 2001, which is when the building opened, of 54%. They got 60% increase, and again, this is only in food excise taxes. This is only from 2003. And this is the most recent number, conservative estimate of the amount of money spent in Stanton in 12 years by Blackfriars patrons. Now, that's a good return on $500,000. And I have to say that beyond the money, it has made Stanton a very famous town now, not very famous yet, but growing fame. So buy property while you still can. These are a bunch of awards that it's won since the theater opened. You'll see a bunch of things here about top 10 places to retire and all of that from magazines I've never heard about, but I have heard of the Smithsonian, and I like that quote, and it is a beautiful place to live. To give you some idea of how we help with the Renaissance, that's a picture I showed you earlier. The most important thing that we did for the town was that a former student of mine came in, saw the Blackfriars. It turns out your students grow up to be important business people. He was working for acquisitions for Marriott Hotels, and so he got a deal with the city, and they fixed that hotel up and turned it in, and you can see it here. It's now a wonderful conference center right next to the theater. And I have to say this about Stanton. Stanton was a very important stop on coming from New York, when shows came from New York. Stanton was the last sort of outpost before you got into the mountains. And in 1901, there were 2,200 theater seats on the main street of Stanton. And that's just remarkable. And then it had the decline, but there was enough old money that they didn't have to do urban renewal. They never got around to it. They were able to stop that. And so now, that's what the city looks like today, and it's really quite a beautiful place. So there's my little appetizer. So what's it good for besides money? Well, you know, it's a pretty good place to put on plays. And here's a pretty interesting list since we opened of authors we've put on. These are early modern authors. The ones with the gray bars are before 1800, but I feel like we're still exploring pre-directed lighting staging. We have put on 66 productions of early modern play, 107 altogether, 66 by Shakespeare. 66 titles, 170 altogether. I haven't done the math about Shakespeare, but we could look back and see it, but I'm moving on. So 12 years, that's an average run of 21 shows. So we're open 52 weeks a year, and so if you come to Stanton, you will see a show as long as you come Tuesday through Sunday, you know. Plus, the graduate program has staged 29 shows, and our theater camp, at the end of each theater camp, they put on a show. And so we've done 60. All of these are early modern. So 196 productions written before 1800 have been on that stage in 12 years. Plus, Stealing from the Globe, who have Red Not Dead, we have something called Bring Them Back Alive, and we do stagings of the plays. What's it good for? Well, it's good for the receipt of learning. As that's my title, that's what I really think it's great for. And that's where I get the most excited. I have this slide that I was actually using to show teachers how to use Shakespearean staging to stage, but it's just so clever, I wanted to show it for you. So I was gonna say, it's a great place for scholars, teachers, and students to meet. And so I did this. Isn't that good? Look at that. Oh, wow. See, they're at desks. It's like a classroom. Get it? So, laboratory. I put a question mark there. The man who currently runs our graduate program in Shakespeare and Performance is a man named Paul Menzer, a good friend, and many of you know him. Paul came and gave his talk for us to decide whether to hire him as director by attacking everything we did and scoffing at the idea that we were a laboratory. It's a very, very wonderful talk. And he pointed out that a laboratory makes it sound like a science. So I put a question mark there, and I've come up with some other words. And I think a dark glass to look through is fine. I don't really care. To me, we have a few control variables. These are all stay the same all the time, so we can keep looking at things. And my thesis is this, that recreating the Globe and the Blackfriars has helped artists and scholars to look back at historically verifiable staging practices and to rethink assumptions about the contemporary stage. And that's what really excites me about it. What we're doing. So this term, original practices, which was sort of decided on officially at a meeting with Frank Hilde at the University of Maryland, and there's a lot of voting about it, we knew there were issues with it because it sounds too authentic. And finally, you have to use some words. But we talked about other ways of putting these words together, and here are some of them. Practical origins. Because it is about being practical. It's cheap to do theater our way. Practicing origins. Original practicalities. So I'm really on the crass side of things. But my favorite one, and the one that I really like to think that the theater is doing something with, is originating practices. So I want you to consider this. What everyone said when Sam Wanamaker said he was going to build a Globe, they all say, well, you're going to put seats in it, aren't you? And he would say, no, I'm not going to put seats in it. And they all thought that would never work. No one would ever stand to see a play for 2 or 3 hours, right? That turns out to have been simply a piece of chronological condescension. People will stand for plays, and not only for plays that were written a long time ago, but I love this picture. This is from the group that produced De La Guarda. They stand for productions all the time. You look up at the ceiling, you see acrobats, and all these people stand for all that time and get moved around the room. So you know, but we just thought, oh, isn't that quaint? They stood. Well, here's some other quaint, early modern things that I want to look at, and I put them into these categories. Willing extensions of belief is what I've called it. Darkness, doubling, cross-gender casting is the first one we'll look at, that grouping. And then audience, large rooms, stools, visibility and agency. And then music, interludes and jigs, and rehearsals. And this comes from the work of Tiffany Stern, as I'll say later. But plays prepared in 2 days using cue scripts, prompters, and no directors. So let's start with playing darkness, doubling, and cross-gender casting. This is from Macbeth 2-2. This is the scene when he's supposed to be about it, doing the murders. She comes out and says that. And then she hears, who's there? And she says, she doesn't say, my husband, then. She doesn't respond. And so modern productions have him doing that someplace else, because modern productions haven't figured out that it's dark. And when he says that, she knows who's coming in the room, but he doesn't know who's in the room. They have to act darkness. And here are Celia Madoy and Alvaro Mendoza in a production we did in 2005. And he's got the bloody hands, and you can see they're acting as though they cannot see each other. There were three ways you could make it dark on Shakespeare's stage. You could say it was dark, You could give people a prop like a candle or and I'm sure you heard about lights, but you could a candle, a torch, or a lantern, or you could act it. And there they are acting it. And in this particular case, it's the only thing that seems to work for the scene, because if there's any light at all, why does she say, why did you bring the daggers, and it's plural, from that place? And she says that 43 lines into the scene. So it's because she cannot see them. So these two, so the original, I think the original actors were pretending it's dark. There's so many things like that in Shakespeare that we've been able to explore. And here's the beautiful thing about it. You see twice. You see the actors, which you wouldn't see if it was dark. And you see the darkness. That's a really hard thing to get with modern technology. And then doubling. This is Miriam Donald, who was in a production of Henry V. This is her playing the boy. And this is her playing the princess. It seems kind of stupid to stand here and tell you that that's a pleasure for an audience to see this. To see an actor acting, being two different things. And it seems a little stupid to stand here and say that, you know, there's some thematic issues that get, I mean, as an English professor, I'm going to tell you, it's pretty, you know, Henry V gets that boy killed. And then he marries the mother of somebody who's going to be another boy, you know. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that's going on with that, that are fun, that aren't about being quaint, that are in many ways more complicated, more interesting than just casting two actors in the part. And this is probably the double that happened. And then cross-gender casting. Now, you know, cross-gender casting is a really interesting thing. I mean, everybody's doing it now. There's whole companies devoted to all men, all female production. But you have to remember, look back. There really weren't many of those before the Globe. In other words, people started thinking about it in ways they hadn't thought about it and not looking down on the idea, thinking, well, what can we get out of it? Now, the idea of casting men as Lady Bracknell, these are two of our actors as Lady Bracknell, is not new. It's been for a long time, it's been a drag, sort of a drag, a cross-dressing thing to do in theater. And that brings up some terrific issues to talk about. When are you casting men as women? Because the man can act the part well enough. You know, and another one is, why not do boys? Anyhow, since it may have been just the oral quality we were looking for. But it brings up that question, when is it drag, and when is it good theater? And when Lady Bracknell comes out, and both of these men are very tall, very large men, and gets a really big laugh, when do the laughs stop because there's a man in drag? And then the real laughs start, and do you want to play around with that? We currently have this production of Romeo and Juliet. And Ben Kearns, who is as large as either of those guys, is playing the nurse. Question is, to me, when you see that, when are we laughing because Ben Kearns makes a sort of odd-looking woman? And when are you laughing because Ben Kearns' nurse is funny? Those are good questions that have nothing to do with quaintness. It's all about how we look at it, define ourselves, and think about gender. I think of all the decisions as a director I ever made, I'm proudest of this one. I'm sorry, not that one. But it's good. It's good that I made that flow, because you laughed when you saw Jeremiah Davis in this part. This is not a drag moment. When that actor came out, he got an initial laugh. This is from Marston's Malcontent. Got an initial laugh. This was put on by the actors without a director. He got an initial laugh. Partly he has a beard, you know. I mean, and within, I'd say, seconds of that, no more laughter, because he was a little eerily beautiful, you know, and there was thought, you know, you start thinking, wow, that's a pretty woman. It changed, everything changed. I got another picture of it because people just stopped laughing. Now, they didn't stop laughing when Lady Bracknell appeared, and they don't stop laughing right now when the nurse appeared. But those of you, how many of you who are with me saw this particular show, The Malcontent? Raise your hand. Well, you'll remember the laughter for Jeremiah Davis went. Now, that's really interesting to me, and it seems to me you could do a semester in a theater class, an acting class, about what Davis was doing to play the part. Here's the thing I was so proud of. In 1998, I cast Kate Norris as Richard III. And she was very worried I was doing it as a stunt. No woman had ever played that part in a professional production before, and I assured it, no, you just simply were the scariest, nastiest Richard that auditioned. And I like only tell this story because it's a good anecdote, and it shows you, you never know if you're in theater, you never know, if you're a teacher, you never know, but if you're an actor, you really have even less way of knowing. She did it in 1998. Among the places she did it was Clemson University. At Clemson University, there was a senior in science named Allie Glenzer. Allie had played around with theater, but thought there were only certain parts women could play, and saw that production. She's now one of our actors. You'll see her again in these slides. And here she is playing the friar in 2013. So she's now playing a male part, and she just plays it as a guy. Here's some quaint musical practices, interludes and jigs. I wish I had a lot more time to talk about interludes, but could I have one of my readers, would you do this for it? The music at the original Blackfriars was quite famous. So here's a quote from Parson's Wedding.
I have got the Blackfriars music, I would fain to say, until the last act.
And here is from Whitlock's memoirs.
The Blackfriars music were then esteemed the best of common musicians in London.
When we audition, we, at the end of the audition, we say, we have everybody in the room sing something. If they want to, they don't have to. Or bring an instrument. We like it when we can find actors who can sing and play. And we have started, because there were interludes at the Blackfriars, we have done as many as four in a production. We have done, we always do at least one. By the way, when we were Shenandoah Shakespeare Express, we didn't have intermissions. We did it like they did at the Globe, we just ran it through. Now we have at least one, because why? Why do we need one at least? To sell drinks, exactly right, to sell drinks. So I don't understand why we don't have more. Jim Warren, my co-founder and artistic director, likes one. What I do now is we do one in the middle that's a regular one, and then I just put in a song halfway through the first act, and I put in a song halfway through the second act, and that gives me my three intervals. So there they are playing for the... You know, there's something about a three-ring circus that's good. And we'll be talking a little bit more about that later. I want to talk about jigs. I'm going to tell you right now that if you had told me I'd be involved in anything having to do with reproducing an old theater, I would have run screaming to the doors like I do whenever anybody wants to take me to a Renaissance fair. And the thing I think of first when I think of Renaissance fairs is jigs. But not anymore. Jigs are great. A jig reassembles your brain at the end of a show. And the Globe started doing it, and they did it. I'll never forget the Mark Rylance's Hamlet where they did it. And to see, you know, at the end of the tragedy, people get up and do a danse macabre, that's a really moving and important thing. And we ought to think more about it. And I have thought more about it. And this is my first clip, and I hope it works, that involves a video. So in this clip, I directed two gentlemen at Verona last year. We had a very weak schedule of five summer fall shows. That is to say, we had no... The biggest title we had was Merchant of Venice. Then we were doing King John and Cymbeline and Lion in Winter, none of which I thought were going to be big winners. And so I needed my show, which was going to be Two Gentlemen of Verona. I needed it to... I wanted people to want to come back, but you probably know it has a very difficult ending in which someone tries to rape his best friend's girlfriend and the best friend then offers the girlfriend to his friend. So now everybody's sort of stunned then, and I want my audience to leave thinking this is fun. So this is pieced together and it'll be jumpy, but so these are the things I did, hoping that people would in fact want to come back or tell their friends, go see it. And it worked. We had, oh, let me go back, sorry. See, now I'm relying. Okay, here we go. And if I, just let me deal with you, go back here. Where was it? Excuse me while I find that. Here, we'll go back to jigs. Starting from current slide. There we go. All right, so try to do this again. All right.
One feast, one house.
So this is the end. This is from the Witt's frontispiece. And if you look closely at the drawing of his audience members, you will notice that one of them is on the right is either asleep or reading. The ones on the right there, the couple on the right, may be talking to each other. I can't quite tell. But definitely the couple on the left is not paying attention. And the people next to them are looking at them, and then this guy's looking at them. Nobody is illustrated as looking at the show. If you think, well, you've chosen this because it does that, you are wrong. I cannot find an illustration of an audience before there was directed light. I cannot, if you can find one, I want to see it, where they're all looking at the show. You can't find it. This is a very famous picture. I was first going to put circles around all the people not paying attention, like I did before. Then I discovered that I just better should do it with arrows, because none of those people are watching the show, and these are the only people that are, five people. Now, that doesn't seem like a great way to put on shows, but it does give you a lot of information. You will see the people with the X's, they've got their arms folded. That's a signal of something. When the arm gets folded, it's a signal. But you've got other signals, too. That person is picking her nails. That person is texting. This person, who happens to be a good friend and is a very smart guy, is zoned out. And these guys are just bored. Now, the actors see that. You go, well, that's got to be bad. I'm going to argue that it's not always. This is in a production of Henry V. These two people on the stools are very carefully watching coins. That guy is watching Patrick Midgley, who was the prince. And this guy's reading his program, right? Now, programs are a big issue. Do you give a program out? Because those audiences will look at it. You know, you give a program so they can follow the plot. That of course, reinforces the idea that they're going to have any trouble following the plot, which is not probably a good thing to suggest anyway. So you've got all these issues around these things, and because the lights aren't out, people will do that. Here's The Tempest. There are some of our people above in the balcony. Two of them are focused quite much on the action in Tempest, but two of them are busy. One of them's just lazy, and the other one's, look at me, I'm in the balcony of the Blackfriars. So how can it be a good thing? Well, this quote from Richard II says in a way that sort of reverses, it's a sort of reverse, it's a negative statement of the positive. As in a theater, the eyes of men, after a well-graced actor leaves the stage, are idly bent on him that enters next, thinking his prattle to be tedious. Well, the reverse is true. If you, as a company, are seeing that ambient attention everywhere, and then you do something to change it, there is a moment in the room that becomes very special. And to show you that, here is a drawing. I took a lot of time on this one. I drew a line from everybody in the balcony where they were looking. And that's what I got. And that's what it feels like to be spotlighted in that. Your focus on the actors makes them focus. And it is a remarkable thing that you cannot get in a darkened room. The stools. Well, nothing is more different about the Blackfriars than the Globe than the stools. The stools are the thing. Because Gallant hired the stools so they could sit on stage. Now, we have stools, as you've already seen. The stools are normally along the side, very decorously in front of the Lord's chairs. So people come in and they hire those, they don't hire the stools, but they get up on the stools because, like Fitzdottrell, they want to be seen. Would you do this one for me, Tom? This is from Devil Is an Ass. This is what Fitzdottrell, who's going to the Blackfriars, says about why he's going there to sit on the stools. Of Richard II, in which the Parliament scene, I asked that the audience be, that the stools be moved out from that wall so that they looked like they were in it. I got that idea from the Globe. There was a wonderful production of Richard II there with Mark in it, and it was great. It was a great production, but one of the things you felt was that the people on the side were sort of part of the Parliament. So I tried that. Well, of course, the problem with it is that these guys forgot to bring their doublets and their pumpkin pants. So they don't look like the other. But look at this from A Mad World, My Masters, and you'll see in which the actors put this show on and decided to use contemporary dress. So this is the mask at the end of it, the non-mask at the end of it. And whose audience and who is actor would be the question. And then I wanted to show you this about the stools. This is my best clip, but for you to understand this clip, you have to read what gets said. This is from The Two Noble Kinsmen, and this is the jailer's daughter, and she has a monologue that ends like this. What should I do to make him know I love him? The man on a stool said to her, just tell him. The jailer's daughter says, say I ventured to set him free. The man on the stool says, that would work. The jailer's daughter says, what says the law then? Thus much for law or kindred, I will do it, and this night or tomorrow he shall love me. Now you're going to get to see what a really good actor, Alec Linzer, does as a jailer's daughter, if I can make this thing work. Just a second, and I'll show you this great moment. You now know what the guy said. You won't hear him very well at all because we have we do not have the V&A's equipment. Let me put it that way. Okay, so if we can make this go. Are you ready with the sound?
What should I do to make him know I love him?
This is in the production of Allswell that's on right now, and our actor here, Greg Phelps, is capturing parolees by throwing a net over him. This is not a very high-quality photograph. And so they are in on the capture of parolees, essentially, and very happy to be so. Here's my big mistake. You see the people on the left and right of the balcony, and you see the projected balcony. Well, the Globe got built in 96, 97, and Peter Hall and the actors complained about the balcony, and so they put in a very pretty projecting balcony, and I thought, oh, that's really pretty. I'd like one of those, too. So we did that, which means that people on the balcony can't see under them, and people on the left can't see that much of the stage, and people on the right can't see that much of the stage, so that leaves that much of the stage for the actors to work in. It's a really terrible thing. And it loses us money, because we say at the beginning of every show, if you want to go up and be in the Lord's room, you can. And people go up there, but the people on left and right normally leave for the second half because they can't see very well. That's not good. So we're losing money, and we should have, you know what, it was chronological chauvinism. That's what it was. We should have said, you know, those guys knew what they were doing. There's a reason it's flat like that. They could have figured out that if you want actors closer, you can build it out further. They decided not to do that. Why? And I think the reason is crass. I think it's money. But above all, I love seeing an audience for their agency. This is what Fanny Bryce says. And would you read this for me, please, Cass?
Your audience gives you everything you need. They tell you, there is no director who can direct you like an audience.
I gotta say, we get shows done pretty quickly, even when we use directors. And we have a season in which we don't use directors. But even the directors, we do it pretty quickly. I now put up a show, I was allotted 75 hours to put up Oswald, right? That's the amount the artistic director decided I needed. I felt like the last 4 days were hell because they were ready and we couldn't tell what to do because we didn't have an audience yet. You know, it wasn't until we get to previews. Here is some of the things that you can get from an audience. These are signals that give you, you've already seen some of them. People looking elsewhere, people reading programs, people texting, people sleeping, people laughing, people smiling, people crying, people with arms folded, people leaning forward, people moving together and or holding hands, people talking to one another, people performing moments and characters. What do I mean by all of that? Here's Much Ado About Nothing, all right? This is the moment in which Beatrice, played by Sarah Fallon, says, kill Claudio. I would maintain to you that the actor Renee Thornton Jr. found that he had two, not one, but two Beatrices to deal with by the time he got. Look at that woman's face and tell me she isn't looking to eat somebody's heart in the marketplace with a few fava beans. And if that's not enough to persuade you, look at the older generation is in support of that position as well, right? So it's a remarkable thing to watch that if you're an actor. You ask our actors about it, and they will tell you how much they miss seeing audience members. They cannot work as well. Here's another example. This is Wild Oats, in which Jack. This is the moment in which Jack Rover asks Lady Amaranth to marry him. Now, this is not as dramatic, but look at the three people on the stools behind him. All of them are like, that's worth considering. You know, they're like looking it over, thinking it through. If John looks to his left, he's going to get feedback. He's got more acting partners than he would otherwise have. Here's King Lear. This is the moment of moments, right? And you have James Keegan with Elizabeth Wilmoth as Cordelia in his arms. I took out the audience. This is what you would see in a proscenium stage when the lights are out. That's what you'd see. This is what you see in our space. And if he looked to his right, and I can guarantee you he would have looked to his right, he would have found this couple, and he would have seen this sign. They are holding hands. They were not holding hands. They begin to hold hands. There are a million signals like this for actors. These aren't signals for people who acted 400 years ago. These are great signals for contemporary actors, and will always be, whatever the period. And here is a favorite moment of mine. This is Gina Hoban as Dalter Sheet and James Keegan as John Falstaff. He's just said he's old. She's just said she loves him. That's all great, you know. But if you're worried that Act 2, Scene 4 of Your Henry IV, Part 2 isn't being taken seriously, which is one of the most beautiful scenes ever written, you know, and you're worried that when your whore says to you if she loves you and calls you fat and all that other thing, that people aren't going to get it, that she is, and you're just going to get laughter at it. Look at this audience. Look at their faces. Now, you can't see them very well, but you can see them well enough to see that this guy is working to look around somebody. This guy is a judge in town. This guy is looking forward, he's leaning forward. This woman is leaning backwards to see better. These are important signals. This man is trying to see over that woman's head, and this woman here has cocked her head in that, oh, in that wonderful way. All of these are signs to our actors. This is very recent. This has got to be one of the great shocking scenes in all of the early modern theater. This is Frank Gullman, Miriam Donald playing Frank Gullman, the courtesan. John Harrell, who is playing Penitent Brothel, has come to meet behind the curtain to have an assignation with a married woman. And meanwhile, they're interrupted because two suitors to the courtesan have shown up, Master Innes and Master Possibility. So to get rid of them, Frank Goldman has a bowel movement on stage. And that's what she's doing. By the way, she was very pregnant at the time, and we were always hoping that she wasn't going to have the baby early. Because she now, that's audience member. Most of these photographs I have not taken. I took the photograph because at that moment I wanted to know what was going to be going on. So here's the photograph. Look at that man's face. Is he horrified or is he amused? But he's channeling Master Possibility. It's the same face. And here, we can tell the three faces you can see. They all think this is really funny. There's a woman here with her arms folded that's not quite sure. This woman is not only thinks it's funny, but I think it's interesting she's holding her nose, as are those two people. So, and then here quaint practices of process. This is an honor of Tiffany Stern. It comes a lot to us. This is our NEH Institute in 2008, and this is the book she wrote that changed everything for us because we wanted to try and see if we could put on plays the way, to rehearse them the way that that actors did then. They prepare their plays in 2 to 4 days. They use cue scripts, they use prompters, and they use plays without they did their plays without directors. So I want you to hear, this is Tyler Moss and Alyssa Wilmoth. Oops, back. This is Tyler Moss, and this is just an interview, so it's not. And you will hear him saying what it was like to work from the cue script. He got to rehearsal a little late, and so. Oh, it didn't work. Oh, wait, let me go back. Sorry. And I see I'm over time, too. I can try to finish this.
Everybody told me this play was a comedy, but I had never read it before. And
I didn't realize it was a comedy either, because according to all my sides, it was just...
Don't rape me, don't rape me.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Don't make me be raped.
We ran through the lines when we first got the scripts. You were visiting in town, and I was a part of this past residency season, and Alyssa and I ran through the lines of Celia and Corvino, and we're both like, oh my God, this is absolutely terrible. How is this play a comedy? This is not funny at all. And I really think that helped, that choice of making it a real bad guy.
I think that's really interesting to me, because why would you want to know the arc of the story if you're the actor? You want to do the scene mean. And if it's mean, you don't want to go, okay, I'm in a comedy, therefore let me cool this down a little bit. And generally, I've become suspicious of knowing too much. And I love playing the moment. This is our prompter, Sarah Blackwell. We do not say line. Our actors say prithee. And I have some anecdotes about that I'm going to forego, but I will give you one. One time an actor went up and he said prithee, and the line that he had forgotten was prithee. And then succeeding without directors. And so I'll very quickly tell you that we started doing this in 2005 here. We do the season between January and March. It was dead. We couldn't get anything to sell. So we thought, well, we won't lose anything. We'll be on mission. Andy will love me if I do enough early modern plays. So we'll do titles people wouldn't come to. So you can see that we have an enormous jump already in our March numbers, and then all the numbers begin to jump. And now that March is now our second busiest season to November, a month to November, because of the Actors Renaissance season. So, and then onward to... So what's the recreation of early modern playhouse good for? Hatching ideas about theater. Less enables more. I really believe that. I showed you that with darkness. Yes, they have to act the darkness, but once you see, you know, you see the darkness with your own mind and you get to see the actors act. Doubling, we already talked about those, some of the advantages there. But set pieces is a very interesting thing. It's a bare stage and it stays the same. And normally you would think, well, that's not, how can that be more? Because when you do something, it rings out. And here is a scene from Tamburlaine, in which Tamburlaine is putting out the, you've been looking at this theater a lot today, so you should notice how very little in terms of scenic design changes everything. When you see this, this is the white, the red, and the black banners. See how everything changes, right? Because it's been bare. So suddenly when you make a choice, it seems bigger. And then here, a cage comes on, which is very unusual. That actually hit Allie, and then she used it as part of what she's doing. And then look at the room go black. To me, we couldn't have gotten that effect if we could mess with lights. So when we rarely use it, it's great. And then I'm just going to say the energy of helping a play increases an audience's enjoyment of it. Every aside, you don't know you're doing work, but every time Hamlet says, should I kill him or not, while he's praying, you're doing some amazing work in helping the play. Every death, when somebody dies, and then they just get up and walk off. I just saw Tim Carroll's Romeo and Juliet in Stratford. It's a beautiful thing of Romeo and Juliet getting up afterwards for the bow, where the father's got them up. And they have to figure out how to do it, and suddenly you have some art. And every magic trick, and of course, here's a very important magic trick. Oberon says, I am invisible, and this is an amazing thing that happens. He becomes invisible. He's totally invisible. See that? Clearly, Helena doesn't see him, right? He becomes invisible. You make him invisible. That's more work. That's more fun. And then I was going to talk about the physical help, actually, in helping enjoyment of play. I believe in the Half Moon's Hamlet, many, many years ago, was a promenade that walked among you. Angels in Architecture recently did a Dido and Aeneas in Soho, where you had to walk around. And Punch Drunk Sleep No More is basically a walk through an installation where it becomes your show. And I think those are all, we think of them as modern, but they're not. And then actor-mounted shows are good, and they're better in ways. They replacing an actor's agency with a director's agency swaps theatrical value to cinematic and literary value. A talk I gave at the Globe, so this talk could be even longer with it. So instead, if you want to learn about it, here's your speaker's conclusion. Now I have to do my conclusion. It's very short. So I go to my other device. We as a culture know that something remarkable happened in the theaters of London. Of the London of Elizabeth and James. The Blackfriars, the Red Bull, the Curtain, the Rose, the Fortune, the Swan, the Hope, the Globe. There is so much romantic power in the names of those buildings that even saying them seems a kind of conjuration. For Lilly, Marlowe, Shakespeare, Johnson, Middleton, Beaumont, Fletcher, and so many playwrights, these theaters were the bottles in which they caught lightning. Little wonder then that for over 100 years, we have wanted to recreate these magic bottles. Nostalgia certainly plays a part in this. But I hope to have suggested here today that recreating these buildings, as I heard Patrick Spottiswood predict in 1986, teaches us something. The Globe and the Blackfriars do not capture the original lightning in the bottle, but they make us consider anew the essentials of the ingredients of lightning: space, actors, audience, and the words they use. In this way, they readjust our thinking about the peculiar human activity of putting on plays. They make us re-examine our notions of that odd enterprise, and though they cannot ever clear away the smog from the picture of what was happening in theater in London 400 years ago, they can clear away any smugness about what is happening in theater everywhere today. And I'm not sure I recognize.
Thank you very much, Ralph. That was wonderful. Less maybe more, but you've proved that more is even more.
Sorry, that's a lot.
Andrew's just going to take the microphone and take a few questions. We are running slightly late, but it would be nice to have a few questions for about 10 minutes, perhaps.
Hi. I was just wondering what when you were saying about the darkness. That was really interesting in the Macbeth and how you acted it. But I was wondering if you'd ever tried taking the daylight effect out and just using the candlelight, because...
Yes. I mean, I've warned people what's going to happen when the Wanamaker opens. because we're going to discover, I'm sure we're going to discover there are many beautiful things that happen in candlelight that we cannot see. And we have electric light. But when we had the chandeliers built, we had them built so that we could, if we ever wanted to, put cylinders on and try it. And I'm hoping that the success of the Wanamaker will feed back to us and that we'll give it a shot. Because I do think you're right. It would be just quite wonderful.
But could you take, you know, you have the daylight effect lights sort of bouncing onto the thing, and then you have the candles on top of that. Could you take the daylight effect out and just have those electric candles?
That's something worth looking at.
Just trying experimenting.
Play with that. Sort of Ginny Tiramani came over one time, and we did a lot of stuff with candelabra just to see how certain kinds of cloth and jewelry looked when you use candlelight, and it's wonderful. I mean, it's great. And I saw a production many years ago of The Winter's Tale at the Cottesloe, where the lights went out all over the South Bank, and it just so happened it was a preview, and Peter Hall had directed it, and he said, you've got your choice, you'll get your money back, or we have a candelabra in the back we can light. And they lit the candelabra, and for 20 minutes, whenever an actor needed to be seen, they just took the candelabra, and it was one of the greatest things I've ever seen. So yes, it's worth looking at that.
I was just wondering, you were talking about the audience reactions and how important they were, and in a theater that size with people sitting on the stage, how do your actors deal with the English teachers who recite the lines with them?
We don't react critically to them since they bring us their students. That is true, though. It is true. And I like to tell people, and it's quite true, that every show we do, because the actors can see you as well as you can see them, they will identify a show to one another by, it was the one where there was that guy with the red jacket on, or it was the one with that woman who kept saying all the lines while we were saying. I mean, that's how they identify those shows, is through audience behavior. There's not much you can do about that. I guess one thing is make cuts that teacher doesn't suspect is going to be there to get it to your 2 hours. We do try to stick, by the way, very, very closely. We try to make sure our show starts at 7:30. It's kind of a rule to try to have people out by 10 o'clock. So we work pretty hard at that. And that just means moving it along, mostly. Anyone else? I'm sorry I went so long. I forgot to look at time, so at least I was having fun.
I have a question.
Sure, Peter. Yeah, I know, you know, as I looked at it's going to be small, and this has been my experience, that the tinier the space, the better the show. Kind of, it works sort of, there's this funny thing about that. I would say, my advice would be, don't avoid things with armies, because if you can figure out how to do it, it'll be a hoot. When we were first trying to introduce ourselves in Stanton, a couple had us to their home, and they had a little living room area. And we did Much Ado in that little time. I mean, it was a tiny space. And later, the actors were so angry at me for making them do it to start with, thought it was the best show they'd done. I think it will produce all sorts of creativity. And I also think that you'll find that courtroom scenes and things like that will suddenly become, it'll really become what's going on in the room. It won't be like there's a play in an audience. It'll be like, this is happening in the room. So my only advice would be not to be afraid of it. Just find ways to work it. We know from the prologue, I think it is The Devil Is an Ass, that the actors, that the audience members would try to move the actors around a little bit so they could see better. Now, I mean, Johnson pleads with the audience members, you know, we're sorry we're not made of glass so you can see through us, so please don't push us around. We know they did it in a crowded fashion, but I think there's some great pleasures in that.
Where are the best seats in the house?
Well, I'm not happy, to be honest, I'm not happy with the seats on the second level, close to the stage, left and right. I'm not talking about the ones I spoke of. They are a little hard to see from. I like sitting on the side because I want, but it's because of proprietary reasons. I want our actors always to be thinking about people on the side. And I should say, they are great. When we do have people up above them and behind them, you will see them act, turn and act. And that is an act to them. And you go, well, that's awful. You know, you're looking at a guy's back. No, it's not awful. Remember when Mark Rylance was doing Hamlet, and his back was to the audience until his first soliloquy. And then he turned around. It can be very powerful. But I'd suggest you sit sort of not in the stalls, but maybe in the galleries from left to right, just because you can see how they work better. You see the actors work.
Does your pricing policy reflect those?
Yeah, you know, you remind me of something. The important thing about when we first opened this place, which was right after the World Trade Center disaster, and I think you could tell, not as much as when you're there, but you could tell it is a beautiful room. And everybody came to see the oldie building. You know, they all were coming to see Ye Olde Building, and we were trying to put on shows. But, of course, they walked into Ye Olde Building, which is so pretty, and they got all religious, you know. Everybody got solemn. So it's like, you know, they're like a church or whatever. So one of the things we tried to do to fix that was we stopped doing reserved seating above. So in the upper gallery, there is no reserved seating because people were sort of frozen, and we started serving drinks off the stage. And we started making sure people knew we meant it when we said, get a drink, go in and see the show, so that we could get rid of that atmosphere. And the policy I keep meaning to suggest, and I haven't suggested to Jim yet, is that we do this thing where we actually announce, if somebody has not taken their seats down below, we urge you, those above, to come and get them later. Well, you know, I like to see movement. And you remind me of one other thing that's important. One of the things we've learned from this is how not to be precious. Our actors are so generous. You saw them entertaining during the interludes. They come out, they entertain, they sing, and a lot of times they just finish their last song and the next scene comes on, and they know there'll be people still returning from the loo, and they don't. It's not like, oh, you'll miss this line. You know, things got less precious when we got rid of the reserve seating upstairs, and because there's more movement, there's a little better vibe.
Hey.
Hi.
How are you? I want to ask, you mentioned Punch Drunk, and I just wondered if you could make a prediction about Sam Wanamaker and how it's going to fit in contemporary London's theatre scene, and particularly work like Punch Drunk and work that I think that's happened in the last few years, I think because of the Globe, of bringing actor and audience closer together, sometimes in a kind of playful way, sometimes in a kind of antagonistic way. So I'm thinking a bit of Tim Crouch's work. And I just wondered where you think the Sam Wanamaker will take us in the next five years.
I have two answers. I'll make them quick. The first one is one of the things, and this is really wrong of me and so on so many levels, but I would like for the Sam Wanamaker to charge as much more to go to that as the Blackfriars charge to go to the Globe. In other words, I'd like the tickets to be really high. I'd like to see what that does. So that's one experiment I'd like to see it happen. It's just what would happen to theater. So the place to be. In other words, a position pricing. And the other thing that I want to say about that is I still am a Shakespeare teacher. And I recoil sometimes from moments I feel are artificially contrived just to be about audience contact, which is what we call it. I love it, though, when people find a really good reason in the text to be with the audience. And of course, there are many, many reasons to be with. I hope that seeing audience, I hope that more and more actors, and this is bound to be the case, people who work at the Globe, people who work in the Wanamaker, people who work at the Blackfriars, that more and more actors will want to know how to act with audiences. Because that it's just incredible. I mean, 2,400 years of actors having audiences, and then for the last century and a quarter, we don't have audiences anymore. And all of our teaching about acting ignores the fact that we have other acting partners. So I'm hoping it will help with that. And I want to thank you all. I know this last question. I did not realize I'd gone over so long. Thank you for your patience. And I wish there were time for more questions, but there just is. Thank you.